So our topic is about personal life streams, and can that data that we're generating every day be used for public good? And first, just a little background on my background and Sean Acor's background. I'm going to talk a little bit first, and then he's going to give a bigger talk on happiness. My background is I started a company over 10 years ago that was really capturing life stream data related to chronic care and health monitoring. And so we were asking little questions every day about how people are feeling and what their symptoms are, and using that to help people manage chronic illness and stay out of the hospital. And that's been deployed nationwide and is now part of Robert Bosch. And then more recently, I've been the co-founder of Catch.com, which is more of a personal, private notebook and journal that you can also collaborate with other people around your projects on. So capturing bits of information about your daily life and applying them to personal productivity and managing your projects from your smartphone. And then Sean Acor is the author of a fantastic book, which I encourage everyone to read, called The Happiness Advantage. And he's going to talk more about psychology and using this data from our lives to understand what makes us happy. So back to life streams and how the data can be used to public good. First is, what is life stream? What is the definition of a life stream? So a life stream, according to the people who are credited with coining the word life stream in the first place, Eric Freeman and David Galernter in 1995, was a time-ordered stream of documents that functions as a diary of your electronic life. And that life stream is comprised of documents, whether somebody else creates them about you, like this one taken from found on Google Street View, or whether you've created those documents yourself. And this is an example of memes gone bad on Facebook, but people are creating a lot of documents about themselves, and we're not always proud of all of them, which is why we're concerned about live stream data, and we're constantly concerned about how is that data being used, because we know there's a lot of data out there that we're not necessarily proud of, and we don't really know how it's being used. And it's here's the biggest data set of all from Facebook's S1 as they go public. Our entire lives are being documented now by ourselves and by our friends and by everyone else we know. Recently in the New York Times, I found this quote. This is sort of encapsulates our fear of how our data from our live stream is being used. If I've Googled diabetes for a friend or date rape drugs for a mystery I'm writing, data aggregators assume those searches reflect my own health and proclivities. And I don't know what's going to happen now that I've Googled to find those pictures I showed you about live stream. But the fact is, we actually have a lot to worry about because we have a lot of data about ourselves. It's very private and very personal that is being aggregated and being used in ways that we don't understand. If you go back to, also back to 1994, 1995, to one of the, obviously, if you look at this quote, one of the innovators of the smartphone and one of the visionaries of the smartphone, your wallet PC will be able to keep audio, time, location, and eventually even video records of everything that happens to you. What you say, all the data about you, who you talk to, where you go, who calls you. And, of course, that was none other than Bill Gates back in 95 in his book, The Road Ahead. So we are worried about this side of the coin in our life streams because most of the business models and most of the money seems to be being made by using our data in ways that we don't fully understand. But we're here to talk about the other side of the coin, which is the nobler use of that same data. Is there a good use of that data to solve some of the challenges that we face as a society? And I'm going to talk about three areas where, and give examples from three areas where I see our life stream data being actually very important in helping solve and understand big problems of our world today. The first is environment. We all are collecting data every day where we are really the sensors on the front line of understanding what's happening in our environment. Another area is justice, social justice. There are a lot of things that happen when nobody sees them and they're unreported. People get away with all kinds of terrible things. And as we become aggregators and reporters of that data, it's possible to really change accountability and transparency around governments and movements. And then the third area I'm going to talk about is health. In one of the keynotes just recently, we heard Ray Kurzweil talk about what can we do to our bodies and how can we live forever. But really, the keys to unlocking our health may be in really understanding in aggregate as a population all the little things that we're doing. Why do some people get better and other people get worse? Why are some people healthier than others? So those are the three areas that I'm going to talk about. And first, this is one example just that my company Catch.com has been involved with. Taking the data from your personal journal, allowing people to build from pollinator.org to build a garden journal on top of your personal journal. And why are they interested in doing this? Because understanding the pollinators that are in your own backyard, the bees and the butterflies in your own backyard, that data is actually really, really important in understanding climate change and how climate change is affecting agriculture. Because the patterns of the bugs that are pollinating all of our crops are changing because of climate change, and we don't understand it very well. But how are we going to get that data? By citizens reporting from their own gardens what's going on. Here's another example. If you're in California, so if you run over a cat or you run over a rat, that data, well, it's not in your life stream unless you report it, but presumably someday your car will be reporting data to your life stream as well, so this may also be automated. But the fact is, if you run over an animal on the road, that data in California, the California Roadkill Observation System is trying to aggregate that data. And why is that important? Because maybe there should be a sign. Maybe the road should be different. Maybe there should be another way of designing transportation so we don't build highways straight across migration paths of endangered animals. So this is another example of life stream data related to the environment being aggregated in a way that can serve a public good. This was the Gulf oil spill tracker. So self-reported data from ordinary citizens about impacts of the oil spill. Now this project was built on top of Ushahidi, which is an open source project that originally started in Kenya in 2008, allowing citizens via SMS to report violence and in their communities when there was a volatile time in Kenya. And it evolved as an open source project. Now it's being used for all kinds of things. Here it's being used today in Syria. People reporting, self-reporting atrocities and violence and harm in Syria via SMS, via Twitter, via email, via the web, any way they can, and also built on Ushahidi. This is reporting and aggregating data so you can actually see self-reported eyewitness reports of violence in the last week in homes in Syria. Now, this is stuff that would be invisible without without aggregating our own data, our own live stream data. And this is terrible data from our live stream aggregated to try to create, hopefully, justice and accountability. So the same exact thing being used to report sexual crime, sexual violence in Tennessee, built on the same platform, Ushahidi. And again, this is an area where crimes are vastly underreported, but finding a way to aggregate and report that data anonymously can create accountability and can cause civic action. Also built on Ushahidi, Ushahidi is the biggest platform in the world for this kind of thing. And so I'm giving a number of examples from Ushahidi because I really love what they're doing. But this was people reporting where they found fair trade, where they found stores with fair trade products. So also the positive side of social action and accountability and rewarding the good actors. So the interesting thing where all of the things we're worried about, a lot of the things we're worried about are data being mined and aggregated for purposes we don't understand, are coming out of big companies in Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas and places like that. the projects that are creating the biggest platform for using live stream data for public good actually created, developed in Africa. And the executive director, Juliana Rodich, is here at South by Southwest launching a new version of part of their platform. So the third one I want to talk about is health. So this is looking at the seasonal flu, self-reported data via another application of Ushahidi. But this is looking at flu season. And this is, whether it's a pandemic or just the ordinary flu, very important to know when flu is striking. And like right now, don't go to Oklahoma. This is probably a good thing to learn from that. Another example, asthma is a huge chronic condition that thousands of kids die of every year in this country. And really the progress for the last decade has been very limited. The outcomes really have not improved. It's been stagnation. We can improve medications and we can try to improve medication adherence. We can do a lot of things on the therapeutic side. But the fact is a lot of what triggers asthma is environmental. It's in the environment around us. So at Asthmopolis is attaching a GPS tracker to your inhaler. So every time you take a puff from your inhaler, that data is recorded and geotagged and aggregated. So maybe we can see patterns in the environment. We can start to learn what's actually happening in health. And that may be one of the keys to solving asthma, because it's not just what we do to ourselves. It's the environment and how we take our medication. It's our whole environment, which we don't have a lot of control over. The study that I would really like to do and see in the live stream is looking at people like Winnie Langley, who on her 100th birthday lit her 170,000th cigarette from her birthday candle. I think this is very interesting and very fascinating because it's not aggregating our live stream data. It's not just about let's look at the average. If we look at the exceptions and figure out, like, how is it that you can smoke 170,000 cigarettes over a 100-year lifespan and not have cancer, people like this may hold the keys to curing diseases like that, because obviously something is going on that we all could learn from. And she died just a couple years ago in August 2010. Right before she was going to go to Burning Man, and if you think that's a joke, actually here are her friends at Burning Man from last year. Actually, that's a little bit of a joke. But the idea is what we want to be healthy and we want to be happy and we want to live to 100. How do we learn the right things to actually enable us to do that? It's not by bringing people into a lab and doing an experiment. It's from the data from our own lives where we're going to understand why are some people happier and more productive than other people? Why are some people healthier than other people? Those are really hard, complicated problems to solve, and a lot of the keys are in all of our own data that's being aggregated through our live streams. And now I'll turn it over to Sean Acor, who's been studying this field for many years.
Good afternoon, everyone. So when I first got into doing this research, they told me that the average academic journal article is only read by 7 people total, which is an extraordinarily depressing way to start an academic career, because as statisticians, we know that that statistic also includes the researcher's mother. So honestly, only about 6 people read our studies, so the chance to get to talk about this research with you guys here today is absolutely thrilling. And part of the reason that I wanted to share that information is that I think that we've been doing science all wrong. And I think it's the reason that people are so afraid of the aggregation of data about us, the collection of information. What I think we need to do is to change the way that we think about the research, the data that actually comes in. And in doing so, not only can we discover ways that we could actually propel our brains and our bodies to work even better, but find ways of rippling that out to other people, which is where I get excited and what I've been doing for the past couple years. So I research happiness, and But I'd like to start talking about how this information can be used to increase flourishing our lives in an awkward way. And it's the very reason why scientific articles are only read by 7 people. I wanted to start with a graph. And this graph I find to be extraordinarily exciting. This graph is the reason that I wake up every morning and get excited about doing my work, which is ridiculous because this graph is fake. It's not even real data. I found this on Google Images one day. That's why those numbers don't even make sense. But the reason that I like this graph so much is because this graph, I think, is the reason why science has been wrong for the past couple decades. See, when we get information about you, when we're studying you, in fact, if I got this data back just studying the people that are here at South By, I'd be so excited as a researcher, because as I look at that, there's very clearly a trend going on there in the data, and that means that I can get published, which is all that really matters. The fact that there's one weird red dot here that's up above the curve, there's one weirdo, and in Austin it wouldn't be quite that case, but there's one weirdo in the room, and you probably know who you are in this room, that'd be no problem as a researcher, because the very first thing I can do as a researcher is delete that dot. I can delete that dot because I know that is a measurement error. And I know that's an error because it's messing up my data. So one of the very first things we do with the data that we collect about you is we scrub it of all the weirdos, all the outliers, so that we can find out our line of best fit. If I'm studying a population, I might want to find out how many Advil the average person should be taking. And so, of course, all my information is going to be looking right at the average. The problem is, as we get all this fantastic information back, part of which Steve was talking about and part of which you've already been able to experience here at this conference, what I'm interested in is how we're looking at that data. Because I believe that if we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average in our companies and our schools worldwide. Or we're going to use this information for negative. This data will be used to actually find ways of being able to charge you more or to be able to manipulate you in certain ways. What I'm interested about is that one weird red dot that's up above the curve, that what we call a positive outlier. Part of what I would want to do is, if I got data like this back, is I want to study those positive outliers. I want to find out why it is that there's some people in this room that are so high above the curve for a given dimension. As we look at your data, as we look at your information, if I find that you're above the curve for optimism or resilience or energy or a health outcome or a business outcome, what we do is we intentionally study you. Because in doing so, maybe we can glean information, not how to move people up to the average, but how we can move the entire average up. Now, this, I think, is a novel way of looking at data that comes in. Because as a psychologist, what we were trained was the opposite. If you fall below the average at a company or a school, then we get very excited. As psychologists, because that means you're either depressed or you guys have a disorder or hopefully both. We're looking for both because that's our business model. Our business model is, if you come into a therapy session with one problem, we want to make sure you leave knowing you have 10 problems. So you'll keep coming back to us over and over again. But the power of this information that's coming in could actually teach us ways in which we could rise above that curve. And part of what I wanted to do is to talk about that side of it. You know, every talk that I give on happiness, nearly every single one, I have somebody during the question and answer period talk about how they think that when I ask them the question, why is it that as a society, it seems our levels of happiness and well-being seem to be in a steady decline. This is the information we're receiving in all of this live stream data that Steve's been describing. Why would that be occurring? And invariably, somebody gets up and says, it's because of all the technology we have. We didn't have this technology in my day. You know, with these kids go on Facebook, they're on Twitter following these celebrities, and as a result of that, you know, there's no way to possibly have happiness in our current society. What they've done is they've decided the technology is negative. Right? And of course, if that's your view of technology, that's the only thing that you could actually envision data collection from this technology actually allowing us to do. What we're finding in the research is that's not the case at all. In fact, if we do the research in a different way, we can actually dramatically increase people's levels of happiness. The other reason I like this graph is because this is not the information we normally get. You look at a news station on your smartphone, and everything about it is about murder and corruption and diseases and natural disasters, and that actually changes the way that we think about the world. So I think that there's a dual live stream that's going on there. There's a live stream that we're actually receiving data as researchers, but there's also a steady stream of data that you're receiving about what the world is actually like, and that changes the way your brain experiences the world. It creates what we call the medical school syndrome, which, if you've been to medical school, if you know people who have, during the first year of medical training, as you read through all the symptoms and diseases that could happen to a person, suddenly all of those symptoms and diseases start being manifest in your life as you think you have those. I have a brother-in-law named Bobo, and which is a whole other story how I let that happen. But Bobo called me on the phone from Yale Medical School, our arrival, and he said, "Sean, I have leprosy," which even at Yale is extraordinarily rare. But I had no idea how to console poor Bobo because he had just gone over an entire week of menopause. See, what we're finding is it's not necessarily the reality that shapes us, but the lens through which we view the world that shapes our experience of it. And what I'd like to do is to talk about how we can change the way that we think about the data that we're collecting about people. And in doing so, discover positive habits and ways that allow people to actually become these positive outliers. I think Steve did an excellent case talking about the different elements of social justice and of health. You know, I just talked to a health insurance company, a very large health insurance company, and they said that part of the way that they make money is they make sure that the people that they're covering actually have higher levels of health, right? Because the more sick you are, the more cost that company then accrues. So they have a vested interest in finding out all the information they possibly can about the people that they're covering and finding ways to increase their levels of health. But here's the interesting part. That health insurance company also covers all the people that are their employees. So they have massive amounts of data about what actually causes people to feel levels of health and happiness in their own lives. And what they found at this insurance company, and you'll hear why I'm not going to name them, is that they found that they had one of the highest rates of depression and obesity of any population that they've studied so far. That was inside the company, a company designed to help other people to be able to make some of these changes. Part of what we're finding is as soon as they discovered that, they were able to then create programs to be able to solve those problems and to mine that information for ways in which not we can create sickness and disease, which is normally how we think about scientific data, but how we could actually cause people to perform at their highest possible levels. Part of what I'm interested in, and you're going to hear why I'm interested in this in just a minute, I'd love to do a brief experiment with you guys. I know there's only, you're spread out in the room right now, but if you're willing to do a brief experiment, I'm not allowed to bring consent forms to any talks anymore, especially South by after some of the electric shock problems I had a couple years ago. But if you're willing to do an experiment with me right now, all I need you to do is to partner up with somebody that's sitting next to you in the room. Just partner up really quickly in pairs of two, and you can definitely get up out of your chair to do this. You're going to want to do this because part of what we're going to talk about is how your thought processes are shaping the thought processes of other people and why data streams can be so important. So if you're willing to do this experiment, I need the person that's sitting close. Does everyone have a partner if they want? All right, so here's what I need you to do. The person that's sitting closest to the exits, which you might already be eyeing, you're person number one in the pair. The other person, you're person number two in the pair. So there should be a one and a two in each group. So raise your hand if you're person number one. Raise your hand if you're person number two. All right, that's not the experiment, but I have to do that now because I did this experiment on Wall Street a couple months ago, and it literally took a struggling bank 5 minutes to figure out who number one in the group was, which explains some of the dynamics going on in the banks right now. But here's what I need you to do. Does anyone in here have a psychology background? Fantastic. So this is my prime. Over the course of your life, you've taken your genetic predispositions, which you were born with, and you've built those up through your self-discipline and your self-control. So you could pass the classes you needed to in school, to get into the jobs you wanted to apply yourselves, to be at a conference like this one. All the self-confidence and discipline that you've been cultivating for decades, I'd like you to use all of that to control your behavior with that partner for just 7 seconds of the psychology experiment if you can. At 8 seconds, you can do whatever you'd like with your partner. But for 7 seconds, you're mine. So what we ask you to do in this experiment is person number one, we ask you to not get angry with person number two when they do to you what I'm about to tell them to do to you. Person number one, don't get angry. Don't get sad. Please, please don't cry like the group I talked to last week. This is so easy. In fact, I want you to do absolutely nothing. So person number one and two, turn and face one another. Person number one, make sure you're within striking distance of person number two. And person number one, just go neutral on the inside. Try and feel no emotions and try and think no thoughts, which for some of you is going to be much easier than for others. Then what I'd like you to do is control your hands, person number one, and control your face. Don't show any emotion on your face. No fear, no flinching, no frustration, no emotion. I'd like you to use your decades of self-discipline and control, everything that makes you into the person you are here today, to control your face for just 7 seconds. Once you're ready, then person number two, please look at them. Make sure you're looking at them deeply and directly in the eyes. And for the next 7 seconds. Person number two, please smile genuinely and warmly at person number one. Go. And stop. Okay, I'm sorry. We're going to do this one more time. Because I want this experiment to work out, and I didn't realize person number one was going to be that bad at it. Person number two, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize you were the one with all the power and control in this relationship. So let's just switch this around. I know you just met this person possibly, but here's what I'd like you to do. Now, my psychology friend knows we can't do this. Person number two's already seen the experiment. It's way too easy to control yourself now, but let's just try it. Person number two, go neutral on the inside, feel no emotions, think no thoughts, and use your decades of self-discipline and control that you've been cultivating since you were born to control your face with your partner. Once you're ready, person number one, please look at them directly in the eyes, and for the next 7 seconds, it's your turn for retaliation. Please smile warmly and generally. Go. And stop. So, first of all, that wasn't great. So success in this experiment meant you did not smile when I asked you not to. And failure meant you smiled when I did ask, you smiled when I asked you not to, so nicely. Raise your hand if you failed at this task miserably, which meant you smiled during the 7 seconds. Look around the room at the people here in this room. That's kind of what I expected at this conference, but a massive failure rate. Raise your hand if you successfully did what I asked you to for the full 7 seconds. So it looks like five people in this room. Now, if we had a slightly larger, I don't know how many people are here in this room right now, we could take the time to count you, but here's what we found when we have a population that would be about 100 or 200 people that would be all the seats in this room. What we find is, on average, 80 to 85% of people worldwide cannot control themselves for the 7 seconds of this experiment, which is amazing. I've done this experiment working with senior-level bankers as well as school children in Zimbabwe. I've done this in 48 different countries. And the reason I do this experiment is because I'm fascinated about the ripple effect. I'm interested in how your thoughts actually end up changing the thoughts of the people around you. In order to do that, part of what we find is oftentimes we look for what the external world is for an individual. Then we predict, well, this is exactly what somebody's level of happiness should be or their health should be. Part of what we forget about is how important your thoughts are to that process and how important your thoughts are to other people's thought processes as well. Your reality actually ends up changing other people's reality. Now, I'll explain why I wanted to do this, but here's what's fascinating about this study. This experiment is predictive of nothing, first of all. So if you smiled, that doesn't mean you're a weak person. If you didn't smile, that doesn't mean you're a sociopath. We're actually going to be testing for that in just a few minutes. What I'm interested in is that this experiment reveals something about the human brain which makes all this data so much more valuable and important. Because what we found is, inside the human brain, if I put myself into a brain scan and I start to smile, part of my brain lights up and says, "Sean, you're smiling." We knew that would happen. But if I'm not smiling and a technician walks by me and starts to smile, part of my brain lights up and says, "Sean, you're smiling." Now, that's weird because I'm definitely not smiling at that moment. But these small little parts of my brain called mirror neurons start to light up. And these mirror neurons tell my brain that I'm the one smiling. So my brain drops dopamine into my system, raising my levels of happiness and enjoyment. And very quickly, my motor neurons cause my face to contort into a smile before I can stop myself. These are the reason why smiles spread. This is the reason why if you've been in a conference like this and one person starts to yawn while you're speaking and other people start to yawn, that's not because you're boring. That can't possibly be it. What's happening there is as you see somebody yawn within your environment, your brain tells you you're the one experiencing that as well. Why I'm so fascinated about this information is that if we can get information about what a person is thinking within their own brain, we can actually find out the ripple effect that they're about to have on the people around them as well. See, what's fascinating about this is that if you have 15 strangers all waiting for a plane in an airport, and you introduce a researcher to stand in the middle of them and just bounce nervously in place, what we find is within 2 minutes a period of time, of those 15 people in a 5-meter radius, 7 to 12 of them either start to bounce nervously in place or tap their foot impatiently on the ground, or they'll look at their watch 4 times in a 2-minute span of time, which is amazing. By the way, you can try this experiment out yourself the next time you're getting on a plane, maybe after this conference, if you want to spread stress and negativity to the other people on the planes. So do this at a different gait. But what's amazing about this experiment is that your thought process actually has an impact upon other people's thought processes as well. And if we could find ways of accessing data about what you're actually thinking about, what we're finding is it's much more valuable than just knowing the externals about the world around you. In order to do that, we need to be able to collect more information about you. And what I'd like to do is to talk about how we collected that information on some Harvard students and the resulting effects that we found there. But the reason I find this to be so important, and I think is cool tie into this conference, is that we thought when we were looking at each of you in this room that we could study you, that we could collect data on you as if you're individuals. Everyone in here has a different personality and a different brain. I don't see wires connecting your brains. But it turns out our brains are much more technologically advanced than we thought. Everyone in this room right now, your brain is connected, not through wires. You're wirelessly connected through a mirror neuron network. These small little parts of your brain make the information that we're talking about today actually important, not just for what we're discovering about you, but discovering about what an effect you can have upon other people. So I'd like to tell you about one of those studies and what we found studying outliers by looking at their data streams. What we found is I grew up in Texas. I grew up actually just north of here. I grew up in Waco, Texas, which I know some people have heard about, but for the wrong reasons. But I loved Waco. I was going to spend the rest of my life living in Waco. I applied to Harvard on a dare. My family had no money for college, but when I got a Navy scholarship that paid for it, suddenly something that wasn't a possibility became a reality. Now, the reason I mention that is that when I first started seeing all these Harvard students, I had a weird experience, because oftentimes I'd find my room full of people that were much smarter than me or much better academically prepared than me, and very quickly my brain could have taken the route of feeling more negative about myself. But instead, I felt like this was a privilege that I hadn't expected. And I looked around, and there were many other students that felt this way. These were the students that seemed to thrive there. They took classes that were outside of their comfort zone, but then might even get a good grade in there, or they might get a bad grade, but they didn't care because they were learning. Or they get involved with activities that are outside of their comfort zones. They would do sports that they hadn't done before. Those students loved it there. They made the most friends. They're the ones who give the most in alumni donations afterwards, which is why Harvard got interested in this research in the first place. But what we found afterwards is I spent the next 8 years of my life watching these students come into the school. See, I lived as a freshman proctor. I lived in the freshman dorms for 8 years. Harvard invited me to do that. I wasn't that weird guy who just stays in the freshman dorms for 8 years of my life. But what I got to see was I got to watch these students come in, listen to their stories, allow ourselves to hear more than just what their application file would have told us. And in doing so, what we found was amazing. Some of these students, no matter how happy they were when they first got into Harvard, 2 weeks later, their brain was not focused on the privilege of being there, nor even on their philosophy or physics. Their brain was now focused on the workload, the stresses, the hassles, complaints. And very quickly, what was promised to be a fantastic environment, they were told they'd be happy once they got there, they weren't. Now, what's fascinating is if I know the external world of Harvard, if I'd studied Harvard the way we normally do, I'd say, you know, look at its beautiful buildings. This is, you know, the freshman dining hall with this vaulted wooden ceilings and Tiffany stained glass. It looks like something out of Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter. That's actually Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter, and that's Harvard. And when they see that, they say, my friends know I study happiness, so they say, Sean, why are you wasting time studying happiness at Harvard? If you really want to create greater good, why aren't you out in the slums of Venezuela? Or why aren't you in an impoverished school in Zimbabwe? Or why aren't you in a children's cancer ward in Boston? Since we've researched in all those places, looking at this vast amount of data, looking for ways to increase levels of happiness, but I think their question is the important one for us here today. If we're trying to create greater good, their question was, why would you waste time studying Harvard students and happiness? Because seriously, what does a Harvard student possibly have to be unhappy about? That's because their notion of what a Harvard student is based upon just a couple data points. Those couple data points are all externals. Well, we know that they go to school with a lot of money, with a lot of opportunities. They've had a lot of successes in the past. Done. These students should be much happier than somebody who's in an impoverished school in Africa. The problem is, if we don't have any more information, we cannot study happiness. Because if I'm trying to understand the role of happiness in somebody's life, if I have everything about their external world, where they live, how much money they make, how many degrees they have, how many kids they have, if they're married or not, if I have all that information combined, I can only predict 10% of somebody's long-term happiness. 90% of somebody's long-term happiness is not about their external world, but about how their brain processes the external world. So what I'm interested in is, how do we aggregate data that actually accesses the internal mind of the individual? How do we get it so that we can find ways of being able to find not just some of those external sources of information, but the way that they process the world? So what I did is I started looking at these students, looking at every bit of data that we possibly had on them. As a proctor, I already had their grades, I had their admission files, I had the essays that they had, I had their letters if their parents wrote them in, I knew how many friends they had on Facebook. We asked them questions about how many, you know, romantic partners that they'd had, which, by the way, for the 4 years of being at Harvard, it's less than one person, less than one romantic partner for the 4 years of college, and 0.5 sexual partners for every Harvard student. I have no idea what 0.5 sexual partners is. It's like the scientific equivalent of second base. But what we found is that with that information, here's what we discovered. We had to actually start listening to the reports. I met with 1,100 Harvard students for coffee, talking to them, hearing information that we might not get if we just normally ask them about the externals. It's a low-tech form of live streaming that now we can do in much better ways, as Steve was describing. And here's what we find. Imagine a student who, ever since they were 1 year old, was placed into a crib wearing a little onesie that they could buy at Harvard bookstore that says Bound for Harvard, and maybe a cute little Yale hat in case something terrible happened. And then ever since they were in special pre-K school that they got into 4 years before they were conceived, they were at the top 1% of their class. Junior high, high school, standardized tests, top 1%. Walk into Harvard on the first day of being there and have a terrible realization. 50% of them are now below average. To put it more poignantly, what I tell these students is it seems as if, based upon my research, that 99% of Harvard students do not graduate in the top 1%. Which they don't find funny either. What makes that amazing is they've decided in their brain, here's the data point I need to know about, somebody's grades. And the only way to be happy is to be in the top 1%. So they've consigned the 99% to unhappiness. And if you study those people, doing some of the methods we've just been talking about, what we find is that the 99% are actually slightly more happy than the 1%. In other words, the 1% slightly less happy. So no one's happy in the system. Right? It's the worst cognitive system for deciding how we create happiness. And by evaluating these data streams, I want to tell you one thing we've discovered that I think is a result of studying these positive outliers. We looked at these Harvard students who were thriving, looked to see what they were doing in their lives, and what we found was amazing. We found a different cognitive pattern for the way that they evaluated the world. What we found was this. How many people in this room have played Tetris? I'm not surprised for this room, but that's fantastic. If you haven't played Tetris, just, you know, it's a video game where shapes fall from the ceiling like they do in real life, and you just rotate them around to make straight lines. The goal of Tetris is to make straight lines. But if you play Tetris for 5 hours in a row, your brain gets stuck into patterns. Your brain actually gets stuck in something called a cognitive afterimage. Now, we would have never discovered this if we had just done our studying the way that we normally did. See, what we did is we were doing fMRI tests of people playing Tetris to look at their spatial memory patterns. But what we found was, after the experiment, one of the participants went up to the professor. She said, "Hi, professor." And he said, "I'm sorry, I have no idea who you are." And she said, "I did your Tetris experiment a couple weeks ago." And he said, "Well, thank you." And he walked away from this young woman. And she grabbed him and she said, "Professor, I need to tell you something. You're going to think that I'm crazy, but after that experiment, I walked out of your experiment, walked into Harvard Yard, met up with one of my friends. We went into a supermarket, and she found me rearranging some of the bread on the shelves to make straight lines." She said, am I crazy? And he said, "Yes, yes, you are. Please stop touching me." But it turns out, we went back to evaluate those individuals, and what we were looking for were their narratives, their stories, more information than what we normally received. And what we found was something fascinating. What we found was many of these students were dreaming in Tetris, or one kid yelled out in the middle of class that he wished he had an L-shaped car so he could make a straight line in the traffic patterns. We don't even make L-shaped cars. His brain was so focused upon, how do I make straight lines out of the world around us? What we're finding is that those students at Harvard that seemed to thrive were the ones that created cognitive patterns that allowed them to experience reality in a different way. That 90% that actually changes our levels of happiness beyond our external world, they were doing one of two things. They were either changing their mindset, where their brain would scan for the positive first, because what we found is your brain is a single processor with only a finite amount of resources, so what you scan for first becomes your reality. So if you scan for the negatives, the hassles, complaints first, that becomes your reality. If you get data in through a live stream or as you're aggregating data through all these collectors, if you're looking for negative questions or ways that cause people to feel depression or obesity or disorder, those are the answers you're going to get. I gave a talk one time at a private school, and they said, Sean, you know, we push our kids so hard. We've been testing them. We know they have high levels of depression and obesity and, you know, and some have eating disorders. So what we've done is we're spending a ton of money every year on a wellness week. And we're so excited. Monday night, we have the world's leading expert flying in to talk about adolescent depression. And Tuesday night is eating disorders. And Wednesday night is school violence and teen bullying. Thursday night is illicit drug use. And then Friday night was risky sex or happiness. And I said, you know, that's a lot of people's Friday nights, but which they didn't find funny. I was on the school board with the entire school board, and it was just silence for 5 seconds. But what I told them was, that's not a wellness week. That's a sickness week. What you've done as you've asked students questions is you've looked for all the negative things that are going to happen, and then you've designed a conference around that, a wellness week that's designed around here are all the negative things, and that even if we solve all those problems, which is why we normally look at data from a negative way, the absence of disease is not health. Health is what happens on the positive side of the curve. So what we need to be able to do is change the questions as we look at this information. What can we learn from those positive outliers to see ways that they've created cognitive patterns that allow them to view the world in a positive way? We also look for their habits, and we've begun researching these as well. As we looked and asked these students about their day, we found that they were doing habits that seemed to actually create greater levels of optimism in their life that resulted in higher levels of success rates. We found that they were writing things down that they were grateful for, sometimes three things that they were grateful for every day for 21 days in a row, which is now what we actually do for an experiment. They were journaling about their most meaningful experiences over the course of their day. They were exercising, which creates a cascade of success throughout our lives. Many of them were meditating, which is actually retraining their brain to undo the negative effects of multitasking. Some of them were writing positive emails each day or giving compliments to people randomly across campus. And the resulting effect was not only were their happiness levels going up, it turns out so were their educational outcomes, which is where I come in. What I find fascinating is if you study this data in a different way, you get a wildly different picture than the one where you have government or these corporations that are looking for information about how to control you. What we're finding is we're finding ways in which people have been able to push against and fight against the genes that they have to make extraordinary levels of change. All of these habits that we've been studying right here are ways in which you can change from your genetic set point, and in doing so, be able to create long-term levels of happiness. So part of what we've been looking at, and I've been working a little bit with Steve and some of his team on this, is how do we get people to be able to track this information where we could watch it? How do we get it so that people, you know, I just did a TEDx talk that was put on the TED site, and I've gotten these amazing emails, or they're in the comment sections, of people who are looking for groups to connect up with to be able to do these habits together. Or they're telling me about other ways in which they've have permutations on these habits that seem to work even better in their lives. What I'd like to do is be able to study, what if that 100-year-old smoker was doing some of these habits that are undoing some of the science we actually thought we knew about the automatic cause of cancer in our lives? What if we're finding if some of the things we knew were scientific facts were actually mediated by our mindset, which of course is what we're finding with placebos and all these and other effects in our lives? And once we have that information, I think we need to change what we do with it. So the last thing I want to talk about right now is, okay, so once we have this information, once we've asked different questions, how do we move from information back out to creating transformation, which is the greater good that Steve was talking about? This is part of what I've been researching, and you can hear why I wanted to do this. What we found is anytime you want to make a change, if you got a card from somebody at South By and you're like, oh, I'm definitely going to email this person. This is the most fascinating person I've ever met in my life. If they have a long email address, we've actually found that you're significantly less likely to email them back, which is amazing because it literally takes 3 seconds to email somebody back with a long email address. But what happens is your brain looks at it and decides this takes forever. Why don't we email somebody else first and we'll come back to this? And as a result of that, you put that card aside and you end up never emailing that person. Similarly, I had a guitar sitting in a case in my closet. William James, the professor at Harvard, after whom our psychology building is named, he said if you do the same habit 21 days in a row, you'll create a life habit. So I tried to record in a very low-tech form of live streaming on an Excel spreadsheet every day that I was able to play 5 minutes of guitar a day. At the end of the 21 days in a row, I look back at it, and because I had no accountability, because this wasn't social, because I wasn't able to share this with anyone else, I had only 2 checks on that 21-day list. that I actually played, which made me depressed because this is what I teach people to do all the time. So I did an experiment. I took a stopwatch and timed how long it took me to get the guitar out of the case. 20 seconds to get it out of the case in the closet. So I bought a $2 used guitar stand, put it in the middle of my room, and tried out the experiment again. 21 days later, I played every one of the 21 days. And William James was right. I actually created a life habit of playing the guitar. The reason that I was able to create that was by actually recording the information that I was doing, by recording the positive changes. I was teaching my brain that my behavior mattered. I got a victory each time, which is exactly why video games are so addictive to people. And as a result of that, at the end of the 21-day period, not only had I successfully done that, but my brain had actually created new neural channels where now it's as easy for me to go play the guitar as natural as it is to brush my teeth. And as a result of that, I've been playing now for over a decade, which has been exciting, but that's not the whole point of the experiment. The point of the experiment is we need to make this information then useful back to people. If only 7 people read our scientific studies based upon this data that's coming in, we've got a huge gap that's going to exist between what we learn about how the human brain thrives and what we do. And if we allow these barriers between us and change, we're never going to be able to make that change in our lives. So what I'd like to do is to be able to hear from you guys as well, to hear some of your questions and to Steve as well about how we could, what questions you'd like us to see asked when we look at these companies, when we look at information. You know, I was just working with a large health organization. This is not the one I was mentioning earlier. I was working with Ochsner Healthcare Systems. And what they did is they said, you know, let's change even the culture by just making one change and then recording how it happens. They have all this information about their health and about their how many people their patients refer to other people. And what they did was they took something from the Ritz-Carlton. They made them within 10 feet smile and make eye contact. And within 5 feet, they had to say hello. That's it. That's all the doctors and the staff and the employees had to do. The doctors actually pushed back. They're like, we're very busy. We're actually saving lives here. We're not going to do this silly smiling experiment. But what they found was the entire culture changed, much like you can feel it here at the conference where there seems to be just this positive vibe with the people around you. What we found is in those hospitals, as more and more people started to become positive, those mirror neurons started to light up. And as a result of that, an entire culture change occurred where people were actually much more likely to smile and say hello. And even those doctors who didn't want to do it had to smile and say hello because other people were starting to do it to them. And the resulting effect was not only improvement in health outcomes, but an increase in the likelihood of patients to refer that hospital to other people, to increase likelihood of them to go back to that hospital to get the care that they actually needed. So what I'm saying is I think that the aggregation of this data could have huge and positive implications if we change the questions, not looking for disease and disorder, but actually looking for how we can increase levels of happiness by looking at these positive outliers. And in doing so, I think we can transform this world and create an incredible ripple effect. So maybe we'll open it up for some questions and thoughts or comments. What, you know, the floor is yours at this point.
Are there any questions from the floor? Go for it.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it. I saw your TED Talk, a couple of weeks. Is this on? I have a soft voice. And I actually took a picture of the TV screen of those 5 points, though I've not started to follow them. But anyway, I'm really fascinated with this area and sort of self-tracking. And I think sort of an elephant in the room question, I don't quite know how to pose it really, is how do you, if you want to users of these devices and apps to share this information, they need to trust that it's not going to be misused. You need to somehow convince them that they're going to be anonymous in this database. So if you aggregate all the data together, maybe to look at statistics and correlations, that you know they're being treated as an anonymous data point, maybe you wash out the location. So if there's a geo component, you associate them with a state, not with a you know an actual set of coordinates or something like this. I mean, do you have any thoughts on how to solve the problem of, I don't know, making the data anonymous and you know convincing the user that they should be sharing all this very personal information, basically? That's my question.
Yeah. So first of all, highly personal data is already being used and aggregated all the time. And so if we could do a little bit of good even at a much higher bar than what's already happening out there, the world's going to be a better place. But for a lot of the things that I've been involved with, it's not the anonymity. It's about sharing with a small group of people that you're going to be accountable to. It's sort of like the old adage that, if you have a goal, tell people about it, and you sort of become accountable to those people that you're actually going to do it, and they ask you how you're doing. The same thing has been shown to be true for a lot of the kind of health improvement things, whether it's losing weight in a Weight Watchers group or a AA, but actually not being anonymous, but being authentic with a small group of people that you trust. Is really one of the key drivers to being able to change your outlook and change your behavior. With Catch.com, we've made it so you can define a private stream, and only the people you invite to it are part of that. So if it's something about your gratitudes or your goals or your diet, it's only the people you invite. And it's sort of like a group messaging.
I think what you're saying is so important too. That there's this fascinating study that was done about mammograms, and you can educate women to get a mammogram, to get a screening, and they find that you educate them and say, "Are you going to go do this?" And they're like, "Oh, absolutely, I'm definitely going to do this." And only 23% of them actually go and make an appointment. Then for a second group, you say, "Are you going to do this?" And so they say yes, and you say, "Okay, what we'd like you to do is to sign your name on the sheet of paper to sign your name, like give your signature." And what they found is the success rates jumped up into the 30s. It's like 35 or 36%, which is amazing, that signing your name to a sheet of paper could actually increase the success rate. But then they had a third part of the study, which is they educated the woman, they made them sign their name, and then they made them commit about when they were actually going to get the screening, when they were going to call for it. I'm sorry. So they would be like, "Tuesday at 9 o'clock, I'm going to call for the screening." And the success rate jumped up to 86%. So what we're finding is the specificity is important, but also the commitment is important. And I think that there's a greater level of personal commitment that occurs once there isn't anonymity. One of my friends at school, when she goes into the gym, she made friends with the person who checks her ID card, and she said, "Here's my phone number." And I was like, "You gave your phone number out at the gym?" But she said, "Here's my phone number. If I'm not here at 6 o'clock, will you please call me?" So what she did is she gave up some of that anonymity. She's not just a random person walking to the gym. He's looking for Liz every time she comes to the gym at 6 o'clock. And as a result of that, she had that accountability. She said, "I never missed because I didn't want him to have to call me." So I think that there's something really powerful about being able to share that information at that level when we want to be able to share that information. I think that's your point. How do we actually make the information that we have go into these streams that are either personal or public? But the other side of it is I'm working with the National MS Society this year. It's the thing I'm most excited about. And part of what we're doing is we're actually having people do these habits, and we're video recording it. We're video recording their success rates and keeping track of it. And so part of what it is not only to encourage those people to do this, but that story then becomes stories that they're going to take those videos and show those to all the other people that are struggling with MS and their friends as well, so that they can see success stories of these people actually being able to accomplish these tasks. And that's what I think we need more of, is to use this data to be able to find those points of success. And I think if we can give up a little anonymity to do that, we're attaching our name to something that actually could create greater good. And I think for that, I'd be willing to give up some anonymity.
Hey, you mentioned practicing the guitar, excuse me, and just switching from a case to a stand. Has that concept ever made it into, that you know of, product design, where if you know that people will form habits, if you're making a small change like that, has there been any efforts to do that you know of?
I think it's all over the place, actually. It's a great question. So that concept's called activation energy. In order to catalyze a reaction in your life, you have to have an initial investment of energy to do that. Look at the Xbox, for example, right? And if I want to turn on the Xbox, I don't have to go up and press this little circle on the front of the console. I can sit back on my couch with my wireless remote control and be able to press the button there, and I'll turn on the whole console. And the reason for that, they found, there's another study where if you unplug your Xbox, Wii, or PlayStation and make your kids do it after they finish playing it, it drops their unwanted video game playing by something like 30%. I don't remember the exact stat. I made up that stat. But the reason for that is because every time they walk by that, they're like, "Do you want to play Xbox?" Their brain says, "No, it takes forever to reach back behind that thing and plug that thing." So they walk on to something that's easier. So I think that activation energy is, we've started to use it in all different types of things. Like you can opt out
if we make it so that you have to opt in to an investment program, most people don't do it. But if you make them opt out, people just naturally save money for their retirement. So I think that what I'd love to do is to see more people be able to use that, not necessarily for playing more video games, but how we get it for, you know, making it to us to exercise easier, or to be able to make it so that it's easier to take the right pills when we need to, or take our vitamins. Or, I mean, there's a book called Nudge, where they found that if you put the unhealthy food high up and low down at a supermarket, or if you put the unhealthy food at the end of the school cafeteria line, that the kids eat healthier, people buy the whole wheat pasta right at eye level. So activation energy, the story I tell in my normal talk is that when I wanted to start exercising in the morning, I failed for a year and a half trying to exercise in the morning. Till one night, I put my athletic shoes right next to my bed. I put a workout routine on the wall. And then for 21 days, and only 21 days, I just went to sleep in my gym clothes. So that the next morning, all I had to do was roll out of bed and put my feet, which already had socks on them, right into the shoes, and I was up exercising. My mom wonders why I'm still single. And it might be these experiments. But what I think these experiments prove is that if we can make those changes you're talking about, what if we can make it so that it's not easier for people to use unhealthy products? What if it was made it much easier for us to be able to give valuable data, or to be able to make positive change, or to donate money?
So I heard somebody talk about it, this kind of analogy to changing behavior. You've got a kid riding an elephant, and how do you steer the elephant? And it's very hard to change the rider. It's very hard to change the elephant, but you have to change the path. And context is the most powerful driver of behavior. Doing things that eliminate work, that eliminate friction. When you're doing product design and technology, you usually call it friction. How do we remove the friction so that the right thing is the easiest thing to do? When we were doing Health Buddy in healthcare, everybody talks about poor patient compliance. You know, nobody's going to do this. And so our whole point was, how do we design this so, you know, it's just sitting there on your kitchen countertop. It's already on, and it's already there with a question, and it's just one click. I mean, you have to reduce things to one click. And a lot of Apple's design has all been around, how do you make it no more than one click to do the core things you want to do? And I think that's key, because the context is what determines behavior, how much work it is to do it. Make the path of least resistance the positive things that you're looking for. So that is a key principle of design and technology now.
Actually, I just want to show you one thing. So I've been trying to create those five habits as well. And my background screen is, I just have basically two icons there. They just use that at this conference. It's my gratitude and my journal. So as soon as I open up my desktop, immediately the only thing I have to look at is there. I'm like, I don't really want to write my gratitude. It's so easy. Just click on. So literally, I don't have to search for it. I don't have to look even on the side. Usually it's the only two icons I actually have on there. And what happens is it decreases the cognitive cost of actually choosing that. And as soon as you decrease cognitive cost, you have the increased likelihood of somebody actually making those positive changes. So that helps me. What else do you guys do? Does anyone else do anything to make sure that they do positive habits or anything like that? How many people have seen that TED Talk that was mentioned? Have any of you tried to make a positive habit since then? What did you do?
I guess I'll get up and testify.
Please testify.
It's more of a comment than anything else, but I saw the TED Talk also, and I thought it was great, so thank you for that. What I did is I introduced that concept to our company. I work at a small company, it's 12 people, and we were having some morale issues. We were having just ways to get motivated. We had been working on a project for a really long time. Everyone was getting kind of down, and because we were getting right near the end, and that's the part where you have to be the most excited. So I introduced the idea, and actually a friend of mine had written a blog post to remind me to remind them, so I dropped off there. But I gave them all journals to make sure that they would write their things down, and more than half of the people said that they appreciated the exercise and that they wouldn't have done that had they not been given that gateway to do that. So from the friend who's not here attending, I'll say thank you for him. But it really helped a lot. It really changed people's mindsets and the way that we interacted on the project. The project ended up great. Everyone was a lot more excited, and it does work. So I guess that's my testification. So there you go. Thank you, though.
That's awesome. Right.
Thanks for sharing that. I think we're out of time. Actually, the... the way that Sean and I originally met is we were working on software that was really about making it easy to journal on your phone. And I was started doing it, and people around me were doing it, and I was noticing that, gosh, you know you can record and capture, you actually pay more attention. This has to change our brains in some way. So I was Googling journaling and the brain, and that's how I came across Sean Acor. So it really is true that, that these tools we're surrounding ourselves with is changing the actual structure of our brain. And the only way to really study it and understand it is by looking at all of this information from our own lives. And I think it's a very exciting area of research, and thanks for coming and learning more about it.
Thank you, guys.